This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In front of Tuesday's primary election, we'll sit down with Michael Howe. He's North Dakota's Secretary of State. That's coming in the second half of today's show. But first, we'll lead off with Dr. John Eichard. He has a lot to say about the future of farming in rural states.
American farmer, where are you today?
Dr. Eichard, welcome to Main Street.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We are pleased that you are with us, Dr. Eichard. And you once wrote this. You said that most American rural communities continue to search for a new purpose for their existence. Let's begin by asking you, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think the purpose for most rural communities to be established out across the country is basically in agriculture. They were established as farming communities. You know, there were timber communities and mining communities in different places where you had those resources. But the most valuable and important resource in most of the areas where we settled in this country were places where you had fertile farmland. And so many of the big cities are in places where the fertile farmland was there to begin with. Most of it's covered with concrete now. But what I've talked about is during my lifetime, basically, we pretty much depopulated rural areas of farmers. And when we lost the family farmers in terms of numbers of farms, which is tremendously important because numbers of families is what supports rural communities. And so those rural communities that were basically established to support those family farms and that were supported by those family farms, then we've seen the kind of decline and decay economically, socially, culturally within those communities. It basically are places left without basically searching for a new purpose since agriculture and the family farming operations have been on the decline.
And you've written extensively about the go big or go home philosophy in farming. Is there an antidote, I guess, to preserve our rural communities in your view?
You know, the trend toward larger, more specialized, fewer farming operations as a result of basically two different things. It was the technologies basically that come out of World War II, the chemical and mechanical technologies. In fact, when I was growing up on a farm, my earliest years, we didn't have a tractor. We farmed with horses, but it was the affordable farm tractors that were produced in the factories that had been producing tanks and jeeps for the war effort during World War II that made those tractors affordable. And then there was the chemical technologies and the cheap nitrogen fertilizer. People may not think it's so cheap now, but it's cheap relative to what it was before and the availability of that. And then the pesticides come out of chemical warfare and so on. But whenever you had the farm tractors then instead of horses and you had the chemical fertilizers and pesticides, then that allowed farmers to farm more acres, to produce more crops than they did before. And so those technologies allowed the farms to become larger, in fact, made it economically almost forced them to in terms of competition. But I think another important factor that's overlooked is in the 1960s and 70s in particular, there was a fundamental change in farm policy in this country. And it shifted away from supporting the independent family farms, which it had since the Great Depression, as a means of kind of ensuring long-run food security, particularly during World War II. There was they really wanted to keep farmers out here on the land to take care of the land. But the shift was they're saying, well, these new technologies that we have, the chemical and mechanical technologies, we could use these farm resources, these lands, much more economically, efficiently, if the farms were bigger and there were fewer and we had fewer farmers. So basically, they abandoned the farm programs that supported independent family farms and started focusing on productivity and economic efficiency. So we will encourage those farms that can produce the most efficiently, and that's going to mean fewer farmers. In fact, in one of the plans that I quote quite often, there was a committee that met in 1963 and said, okay, we've already lost about 30, 40% of our farmers, but we need to put in place policies so that we will lose another third of our farmers within the next 5 years. And that was the intent of the policy. And the whole idea was to make it more efficient. And so we continued to follow that policy of increasing productivity and efficiency ever since. And basically what the programs do today is they absorb the risk of these large in what I call industrial farming operations. These operations are tremendously productive and economically efficient, but they're also tremendously risky, like when you're planting thousands of acres in one crop. So if you didn't have a government program to come in as we have today, so you could ensure the yields and even ensure the price on that crop, then no individual farmer would be able to afford to take the risk. But basically the government's been taking the risk. So if we had a shift in farm policy again to support the independent family farms that would farm that land in a way that would take care of the land and would contribute to rural communities, farmers that are committed to being a part of the community, socially, ecologically responsible farming, as opposed to just increasing productivity, we could see a fundamental change in agriculture and rural communities within a couple of decades.
Do you sense that that's happening, or do you worry that it won't happen because of the economics of large farms?
Well, I sense that there's growing awareness that there's something fundamentally wrong with this farming system, industrial farming system that we've created. There's a growing awareness, for example, of the environmental problems. The water quality problems are probably the most obvious. My wife and I just moved from southern Iowa down to southern Illinois, but I think it's becoming aware that Iowa, with its focus on corn, soybeans, hogs, chickens, maximum production out, they basically destroyed the quality of the water in the whole state. Most of the streams and aquifers there are impaired, with more than half of them in the EPA standard or EPA testing that they have to turn in are considered to be impaired waters. One of the water quality experts who's been doing the monitoring all across the state for the last several years has basically said there's only one area of Iowa that's salvageable, which is the Northeast. He calls the rest of it kind of a sacrifice zone. And then there's also increasing awareness of various diseases and cancer associated with rural areas have much higher incidence. And so there's growing awareness of the public health problems and the environmental problems, but also I think there's increasing concern about the negative impact it's having on rural communities. When we talk about the rural-urban divide, you know, the people that are in these communities, you know, they've got a sense that it's not just the hand of the free market that's caused their communities to wither and die, but it's a matter of intentional public policies. And so with that awareness comes the possibility then that you will have a increase in public, basically public opinion is what changes public policy. The politicians don't lead, they follow. And so whenever people come together and realize there are environmental problems, there are social problems, there are public health problems associated with this industrial agricultural system, then they begin to ask. And of course, climate change is another one that I hadn't mentioned that's increasingly associated with industrial agriculture. And so as they become aware of those problems and begin to say, look, there's something fundamentally wrong here, we need to look to alternatives. And basically that's what I've spent the second half of my academic career, 30-year academic career, and what I've been doing since I retired more than 24 years ago is work with people who are working on what I see as the alternative system, the replacement for the industrial agricultural system.
Dr. John Eichert is my guest. We're enjoying our conversation. He'll share his perspectives on food, farming, and community as part of the Barnes County Historical Society's 150th birthday celebration. He's a nationally and internationally known writer and speaker, and he will be at the Valley City Eagles Club on Thursday, June 13th at 7:30 p.m. I wonder, we have an appetite for inexpensive food, Dr. Eichert. How do you mesh together your thoughts on coming back to maybe smaller, more sustainable farms that we'll talk about in just a moment, but our thirst for lower prices, especially in this era of inflation?
Right. Well, I think it's a fallacy when people talk about the idea that the larger farming operations are essential for keeping food prices affordable. Let me put it that way. When we went through the early part of that transition, particularly between like the late 1960s, early 70s, and the 1990s, we saw a significant drop in the percentage of consumer income that was spent on food in this country, from about 17-18% down to about 9 or 10%, basically cut in half the percentage of consumer income that was spent on food. But since the 1990s, food prices have actually risen faster than the overall price of inflation index. And in some of the operations, like in the large confinement animal feeding operations, which are so defended so diligently by the industrial agricultural establishment, meat and animal product prices have gone up faster than overall food prices. And that's been a period of time whenever we've had increasing consolidation of larger and larger farming operations, cropping operations, but larger and larger animal feeding operations going from the independent family farm feeders into the large contract operations with the large agribusiness corporations. And we've also had increasing consolidation in the processing, food processing and distribution. So what we've done when we created that system, we created a system now where rising food prices are a consequence of the industrial food system, the industrial agro-food system, as I called it, rather than looking at lower food prices. And I think the other thing that's important that's often overlooked is today at the farm level cost, or what the farmers get from what we spend at the grocery store, is less than 15%. In other words, if we spend a dollar at the grocery store, then what the farmer get on average across all the different foods there is less than 15 cents out of that dollar. So let's say that it cost us 50% more at the farm level. I don't think it would cost that much more, but let's say it cost 50% more at the farm level to produce foods that didn't pollute the environment, that didn't risk public health, that didn't contribute to climate change, that didn't destroy rural communities, that actually added population and added prosperity to rural communities, and it just cost us 50% more at the farm level, then that means that food prices at the retail level would only be up 7.5%, half of that 15%, not half of that total. So what's going on in terms of food prices today is not a consequence of the high cost or low cost of farm level production. In fact, what happens on the farm economically has very little to do with what happens to food prices at the retail level. What we've seen over the past couple of years is not a consequence of higher farm level prices. There may have been higher prices, but the higher prices at the grocery store is not a consequence of that. What we're seeing at the grocery store is a consequence of the concentration of economic power in that system as a result of having industrialized production, but also have consolidated processing and distribution. And so this whole idea that we can't change farming because food prices would go through the ceiling is just an economic myth. And what I'm talking about here, the statistics that support this are readily available. USDA statistics that are online, Department of Labor statistics, and to support the kind of things that I'm talking about. I don't know why more agricultural economists don't seem to be willing to address the reality of this myth that we can't afford to farm in an ecologically and socially responsible manner because we wouldn't have affordable food prices. It's simply not true.
Dr. Eichard, you talked generally about policy or the need for policy change. Specifically, what policies are you thinking about?
Well, for one thing, I'm thinking about, a fundamental shift like I talked about back in the 60s and 70s, whenever we said, okay, we're going to shift from this idea of supporting independent family farms as a way of providing food security, which logically is the only logical justification for having farm policy separate from commerce policy, energy policy, or whatever. So I'm talking about a fundamental shift that says, okay, what we need to do now is focus on an ecologically sound, socially responsible agriculture, and the role of public policy needs to make this economically feasible for farmers to farm that way.
How can most farmers really want to do that? The
way I would have suggested is saying, okay, rather than having the crop insurance that we have now that ensures the yield and ensures the price on specific commodities, we shift to a whole farm net revenue insurance, where we basically insure that farmers that are out here that are put together a farm plan that protects the environment, conserves soil, doesn't pollute the water, reduces greenhouse gas emissions, and limit those to say the farms would be the size that would support a family, a full-time farming family. And if a family is willing to farm according to a plan that would be improved to qualify for this, then we will ensure that this family makes an income equal to the non-farm family incomes in the area where they're farming. That's what I've suggested. If they have a good year and they make a lot more money, then that's fine. But if they have a shortfall, then the shortfall will be made up through government programs. Basically, what we do now for the large commodity producers, some of them receiving multiple millions of dollars in payments, we're saying to the large farmer, you can plant the whole county in corn if you want to, and you can insure that, and the government will cover 60% of the cost of that insurance. And we will ensure that if you plant those 1,000 acres in corn, that if there's a shortfall, that if you don't make a profit on that corn, the government will make up that profit so that you make a profit based on what the prices are offered early in the season when you plant, and how much of the crop that you insure, and this sort of thing. We'll guarantee that you don't lose money on that. So what I'm saying, we'll say to a families out here that if you want to transition over, or if you want to get into agriculture, and you're going to produce in a way that protects the natural environment, that contributes to your local community, that doesn't create a nuisance, doesn't contribute to climate change, then we will pay you, we will ensure that you have a farm family income that's equivalent to the non-farm families in your communities. That's basically what the parity prices were back in the 1930s. If you go back and read the farm legislation of the 1930s, 1938 specifically, it says that what they were doing was they were setting prices. So if farmers received that prices on average, then farm families would have a farm family income that would be at parity with non-farm families. And what I'm suggesting is a transition like that. And so if you limited payments to the amount that it would take to make up for any shortfall for a farm family, then you would never have a government outlay for any single farm that would be greater than the average non-farm family income in that area, which means that if you planted thousands of acres of corn, then the maximum you could get back would be, you know, whatever it would take to support an independent family, not the thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars that they're receiving today in these large operations.
So, Dr. Eckerd, you now have been promulgating these policies for a while. What are you hearing back from policymakers, and do you sense they're getting traction?
Well, I think there's a growing political traction for something that changes things. There's the Family Farm Reform Act that come up, for example, and one of the provisions of it would have a moratorium on the large confinement animal feeding operations. And what they proposed in there, that for those feeders that have been contract operators that have been borrowed large amounts of money to build these large confinement animal feeding operations, and if you put a moratorium on them, then that those operations then that they would pay them, to close down the operations, and they would make sure that they could pay off their debts. So there's people talking about those sorts of things. There's been proposals for a moratorium on CAFOs in the state of Iowa, for example, that's supported by more than 60% of the people in the state of Iowa in a survey that was done across the state. So the majority of the people were supporting that. There's been changes in the animal welfare laws associated with these big operations. I think the focus right now is on the large confinement animal feeding operations, because I look at them and call them, they're kind of the epitome of the industrialization of agriculture. All the things that I've talked about that are problems with industrial agriculture, they're major problems there. But I think there's growing awareness also that something needs to be done on the cropping systems to protect water quality. But it's been more contentious there, and I haven't seen proposals that have really that I would characterize as being transformational kind of policy proposals at this point.
I can see Big Ag and all of their lobbyists just shifting into high gear here. Is that happening, do you sense?
Yes, it has happening. With a growing concern, then several years ago, the big ag companies all got concerned about their public image and hired some of the major PR firms in the country to start putting together programs for them. They're in even starting in elementary schools and particularly in high schools with the Farm Bureau and the commodity organizations, pork producers, beef producers, and so on. And when you hear the ones that are defenders of agriculture, the commodity organizations, they want to support a specialized agriculture, so they maximize the production of their particular commodities, and so they're promoting this idea, and particularly with growing concern about agriculture's contribution to climate change. And there's a major initiative talking about how agriculture can address climate change, and there's all sorts of programs talking about how farmers are stewards of the land, and most of the farmers are. I think what we're talking about here, it's about 10% of the farmers produce about 75% of the output. So whenever I'm talking about the problems, I'm talking about the 10 to 15% of the farms that are in these big operations. And that those that are operate these big operations today, then they're kind of caught in the system because they've got so much money invested in land and equipment and that sort of thing, and they can't get opt out of the government programs. But so I think there will be tremendously difficult to politically to bring about the changes that I've talked about here, but it can be done, and there's growing public awareness that there's a fundamental problem. And I think if we can address some of the fallacies that industrial agriculture feeds the world, which it doesn't. 70 to 80% of the people in the world are fed on farms that we would consider in this country small, and about 30-35% of the people are fed on farms that are less than 10 acres. And it's not industrial agriculture that's feeding most of the people in the world, and it's not industrial agriculture that will feed most of the people of the world in the future. And so if we can address some of these fallacies that have been put forward as a defense of the industrial agricultural system, then I think we can begin to gain more public traction for fundamental change. There's been a whole alternative agriculture movement. It's most visible in the organic farming movement, which has gained a lot of traction. They've applied a lot of industrial things to that, but the organic movement's really been going on fire in the early 90s and continuing to grow. But there's also, now we hear about regenerative agriculture. I've been involved in sustainable agriculture globally. There's agroecology, there's regenerative resilient agriculture. There's a whole alternative agriculture movement that's been going on for 30 or 40 years, and it's been growing. It's still less than 10% of the total out there today, but it's been growing. I think that there's hope out there, and there's alternatives for the future, and there's different ways of doing this, and I think the challenge is to get it across. I put all of this under what I call the conceptual umbrella of sustainable agriculture. I can't tell you how long that we can continue to prop up the agriculture that's destroying the productivity of the land, degrading, the quality of life within rural communities and societies. But I can tell you that it's not sustainable.
Well, Dr. Eichert, there is so much more to discuss, and you can hear him in person in a talk that's titled 50 Years That Changed It All, Food, Farming, and Community. Dr. John Eichert, he's a professor emeritus in agricultural economics at the University of Missouri, and he will share his perspectives on food, farming, and community as part of the Barnes County Historical Society's 150th birthday celebration. A nationally and internationally known writer and speaker, he will be at the Valley City Eagles Club on Thursday, June 13th at 7:30 p.m. There's no cost to attend. Dr. Eichert, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Stands the American
bomber. More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Michael Howe is North Dakota's Secretary of State, and he sat down with us at Main Street prior to Tuesday's primary election.
Listen to the candidates, find out what they say. Put them to the test, figure who is best, and vote on election day.
Secretary of State of North Dakota, Michael Howe, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is the day before the primary elections here in North Dakota. Is the state ready?
The state's very ready. North Dakota has been preparing for this election since the last statewide election, which is in November of 2022. I took office in January of 23. We hit the ground running in preparing for the next statewide election, which of course is tomorrow, June 11th, 2024. Been meeting with county auditors all across North Dakota over the last 18 months. We've had mandatory statewide election training for our county election officials. We've had regional trainings. We have had weekly virtual Teams meetings with our county election officials. We are ready, we are prepared. The citizens of North Dakota will be able to cast their ballots tomorrow.
We hear often that folks who attend polling places are aging, the election judges, it's harder and harder for us. Are we okay this time around?
We're seeing the same thing. Thankfully, we've got a broad network of veteran poll workers that are coming back again this year. Some of our larger counties have said, you know, we're good on poll workers, but please apply and get on our list. Someone could get sick. There could be an emergency. Always having that deep bench of poll workers, not only for tomorrow, but November or 2026, it's always good. Some of our rural areas, yes, it is much harder to find enough poll workers. That's why some of our counties here in North Dakota have chosen to be a vote-by-mail county. They still have one polling location open on election day, but a bulk of their ballots come in through the mail.
You and I were talking about that before we began the interview. Question that may be on people's minds, because part of North Dakota does vote by mail, we've heard nationally, how do we know it's safe and secure? How do we know that it works here? You're confident, I think, that it does.
Very confident. We have a voter ID law here in North Dakota that applies to in-person voting, which many of your listeners are familiar with, but it also applies to vote by mail and absentee, which some of your listeners may not be familiar with. Once you get your absentee ballot application, you fill out your voter identification number, your date of birth, and then you sign that. You stick that in the mail, that goes to your county election official. The county election official will look at that application, verify this is who it says it is, who lives at this address, and only then, upon identity verification, will that person be mailed a ballot. And then that ballot can be filled out, put back in the mail, and as long as it's postmarked the day prior to the election, so today, June 10th, if you're voting by mail in the primary, your ballot must be postmarked by 5 p.m. today, then it will count as long as it arrives to the county 13 days after the election before the county canvassing board meets. So there is that verification process. North Dakota does not mass mail out ballots to anyone. There must be an application. There must be identity verification in order for you to participate by voting by mail and absentee.
Voter participation is an issue all over the country. Looking at North Dakota's numbers, especially with younger voters,
yeah.
I've experienced a couple of elections, bond issue elections, since I've been in North Dakota, which hasn't been too long. And the turnout, to me, seems small. Does that concern you as the person in charge of elections in the state?
It's disappointing, very much so. In 2022, our June primary had 18.8% voter turnout. That's not good. Just last week in South Dakota for their primary, they had 17% statewide turnout. If we could get the broader public to understand that this is the only opportunity to vote for your city leaders, the only opportunity to vote for your school board. Yes, we've got a very large presidential election in November. We're going to have very large turnout in November. The presidency, obviously, is the highest office in the land. But when you think about what affects you the most, it's probably your property tax statement. It's probably your child going to public education. The people and leaders that set those policies and implement those taxes, the only time you can decide on those leaders, that's at the June primary. Yes. If we could have a larger turnout, get people more engaged in that process of understanding what happens in June.
What about getting access to younger voters? Is there anything that you try to do relative to, I don't know, civics education, or would like to tell a high school senior who's now old enough to vote why it's important to vote today or tomorrow?
So we've done a overhaul of the Secretary of State's website, and we've got materials for college-age voters. We've been very active on our Secretary of State social media accounts of what the voting process looks like, how to vote, where to vote. There's also that fine line our office walks too of being a voter turnout operation or a voter availability education information station. That's the approach our office has taken. Political parties, candidates, we rely on them to drive the voter turnout. I feel our office's responsibility is to make people confident in the electoral process, arm them with the correct information, make them aware of where to vote and how to vote. If the public has that and then that results in increased voter turnout, well, then I will not complain one bit either.
Mr. Secretary, you have seen other secretaries of states across the country talk about maybe problems with the way people vote, confidence that they have in the way their states vote. Where does North Dakota rank on that list in your eyes of a voter being confident that his vote will be counted and that the election is very secure?
Number one, I'm very biased, of course, as the Secretary of State of North Dakota, but I feel our laws and processes are best in the nation.
Is there anything you'd like to change?
No, not one bit. We are unique, and North Dakota is the only state without voter registration.
Now that it surprised me, too, when I moved to the state. Very surprising.
Now, that doesn't mean we don't have checks and balances to ensure only North Dakotans and U.S. citizens are voting. We absolutely have that. But you need one of four forms of ID to cast your ballot in North Dakota: a driver's license, a non-driver ID, long-term care certificate, tribal ID, or tribal letter. That's it. That's all you need. And then you need to be a resident of the state for 30 days, 18 years old, and a United States citizen. If you meet all those qualifications, go cast your ballot and vote. I think the way we do things in North Dakota, and plus the policies put in place by the state legislature over the years, ensures the integrity of North Dakota's election process.
We've all gotten a lot of advertisements in our mailboxes, and we've seen nonstop advertisements on television, and people have raised a lot of money to support their campaigns. Yeah. Does your office at all integrate with campaign finance and accountability for candidates, and how's that going?
Campaign finance, yes. Our office is the filing cabinet for state government, and for candidates, we receive their campaign finance report. For this election, for the June election, every candidate running for statewide or legislative office or judicial office will file a pre-primary campaign finance report. That was due several weeks ago. Between now and today, if a candidate has received a contribution over $500, that candidate would have 48 hours to report that to the Secretary of State's website in their campaign finance filing. But that's basically where we stop. We are not an investigation arm. We are a reporting and then transparency website. So if someone is breaking campaign finance laws, you know, we can be made aware of it, but we would say, well, you need to contact the proper law enforcement official who then could turn that over to a prosecutor and seek criminal charges.
Does the impact of political action committees concern you relative to the transparency you're trying to provide North Dakota voters that may not be available for PACs that have filled our mailboxes?
We are North Dakota's transparency arm. I'd be lying if I said North Dakota has the best transparency in campaign finance laws. That's something I've been working on with the legislature here during this interim period. How can we make the public more aware of who is funding a campaign, who may be influencing a candidate? Right now, I'd say our laws are not up to snuff there. And we can certainly improve on that, the campaign finance aspect piece. But as far as the enforcement investigation of it, like I said, that would have to go to another agency, as we're a big filing cabinet. But being a filing cabinet, we want to be open and transparent too, and let everybody file through the records too.
Let's talk about your office in general, Mr. Secretary. Are you modernizing things since you've come here relative to either your business practices or making data available, for example, to voters or to citizens of the state? What's going on?
Well, I'd say the one thing that the public will see right away, if you go to our Secretary of State's website, sos.nd.gov, the website is far different than it looked prior to me taking office. The website prior to me being in office, there was everything on it. The problem was, there was everything on it. It was very hard to decipher and find what you were looking for because it was a lot of information all in one place. We have streamlined that process. We've organized it into a very easy-to-use functional process. Our campaign finance report website, the legislature just appropriated money during the 2023 session. That will be much easier to use and transparent and easy to search for the 2026 election cycle. We're still going through that RFP process now to acquire a new campaign finance site. North Dakota, just this spring, was named the best place to start a business. They didn't cite what we do at the Secretary of State's office, but we do play a very important role when someone wants to take that risk and start a business. You file your LLC, you file your trade name with our office. It was well documented about a decade ago at the height of the oil boom. It would take about 6 weeks for you to get your business license. The old saying is time is money. Right now, it takes about a day and a half, 2 days for that process. That process has been sped up where over a year ago, before I took office, it was in that 4-day period. So we're becoming more efficient in that process. And we're always working to streamline and make it as expedient as we can for that person taking that risk, starting their own business.
We're enjoying our conversation with North Dakota Secretary of State Michael Howe, a new father.
Yeah.
Mr. Secretary, are you well rested today?
As rested as I need to be. We were very blessed to be first-time parents about a month ago, and everyone's happy and healthy, and that's all we can ask for.
Back to the election, Mr. Secretary. When you notice or your office is made aware of something that might be deemed as misinformation, what's your role in either responding to those requests or making sure that what people hear about candidates is accurate and true?
So we want to be the trusted source of election information. If you are out there in social media world, or you're at a barbecue conversing with somebody and you heard something, the old saying, if you hear something, say something. Don't say something on your own social media site and spread the wildfire. If you're curious, if you have questions, our office is more than happy to walk you through that process, hear your concern, and then address that and get you the correct information. And then we would say, please share that with somebody else. Spread the good information. We get reports all the time. Hey, I heard this, I heard that. We'll ask a few more questions and try to verify what they heard, if that is correct, or maybe they just misunderstood something, and clarify what North Dakota's process is, what North Dakota law is, and hopefully that can calm fears. But again, we are the trusted source of election information in North Dakota. We're not the trusted source of election information in Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia. So that's very important for your listeners to understand. North Dakota has different election laws compared to the other 49 states. So what you may have seen or heard occurring in another state regarding the election, keep in mind that may not always apply here in North Dakota.
You've created the North Dakota Election Hero Award.
Yeah.
What is that?
So that was an idea that spurred out of our National Association of Secretary of State. That's our bipartisan organization that secretary offices are involved in. And they, along with the EAC, Election and Assistance Commission, created a day to celebrate poll workers. Elections can't happen without volunteer poll workers. And we honored a poll worker up in Langdon this past fall who'd been at the polls for over 20 years, is working the election, I believe, tomorrow up there. And that was a way to celebrate her efforts, but also highlight we can't have elections without volunteers. And so hopefully that can encourage more people to stay involved in that process. We rely on them. If we don't have them, we can't conduct elections.
What is the North Dakota Blue Book?
The North Dakota Blue Book is an all things historical look back at everything North Dakota. So we published that. The Blue Book really was brought back from the dead, I guess, by Secretary Jaeger. It was a publication with stats and information about all things North Dakota government and trivial matters of North Dakota. Secretary Ben Meyer, during the North Dakota Centennial, had a centennial version of the Blue Book, but it wasn't published regularly. When Secretary Jaeger took office in January of 1993, he has published a biennial version of the North Dakota Blue Book, and he's very proud of it, as he should be. So this past Blue Book that came out for 2024, my name is under it, but about 80% of the work was done by my predecessor. So as we look forward to the next version of Blue Book, we'll have a hands-on approach in crafting that and publishing that. But it is a historical look at everything in North Dakota, from the way state government functions, to our tribal partners, to our state parks, rodeo queens, Miss North Dakotas, all sorts of information is included in that book that can be available at the State Historical Society for purchase.
So now you're the person to beat relative to North Dakota trivia contests.
Right? Yeah, I'll have the cheat sheet maybe. I don't know if I'll remember it off the top of my head.
You participate in naturalization ceremonies. Yeah. What do you feel when you're at an event like that?
A lot of things, a lot of different emotions. My first one I attended was last fall up in Grand Forks. And to see a room of people who worked very hard and took a lot of time to become a U.S. citizen. And then once they raise their hand up in the air and what they are achieving then, and the freedoms that I think a lot of Americans maybe take for granted, they are now getting for the first time. And the privileges, most importantly, at least from our office, is now the right to vote. So that's my role when I attend naturalization ceremonies. I tell the newly sworn in Americans, you have a say in our democratic process now.
Somebody's listening right now who has never voted yet is eligible to vote. In addition to what you just said, this is maybe a person who's lived here for a long time, might even be a native of this state, but hasn't voted yet. What's the Secretary of State in North Dakota's message to that person?
Participate. Participate in the process. You, as a citizen of North Dakota, a resident of North Dakota, a citizen of the United States, you have a privilege and I think a responsibility for yourself, for your neighbors, for your friends, for your family, to choose who you think should lead you at the state government level and national level too, and local level. It's very easy to vote in North Dakota, as we outlined. You just need that ID. If you're in your car listening to this right now, you probably have a driver's license in your pocket. That's all you need, and it's very easy to find out where to vote. Vote.nd.gov, you can find out where your polling location would be, what the hours are. As someone who hasn't voted, maybe it is an intimidating experience, but I promise you, you'll get to the polls, you'll be greeted by someone with a friendly face, happy that you're there, that you're casting your right and your civic responsibility.
What's the biggest challenge that you're facing now, Mr. Secretary, now that you've been in office here for a little bit and you look down the road for North Dakota? What is just up there on your radar?
So as the Secretary of State, I sit on several constitutional boards. Among them is the land board, which oversees state land, state mineral rights, state lands, and then those monies are deposited into the trust lands account, which funds K-12 education. Most of that money comes from the oil and gas industry. North Dakota, a lot of people understand how important that industry is, not just for jobs, but to the future of North Dakota. That is a big challenge we see coming maybe from, not inside North Dakota, but outside our borders. We have the cleanest oil and gas produced in the world right here in North Dakota. So as we talk about getting election information out, I think it's North Dakota's role to the rest of the country and the world. Absolutely, we need a clean environment, but we're doing that in a way here in North Dakota that I think the rest of the world can model.
Can this state continue on in your eyes with its energy production to meet the needs of K-12 schools and other entities in this state? Or are you worried about maybe 20 years from now, there'll be some hard decisions to make?
Well, the Common Schools Trust Fund contributes about 20% of property tax relief off the top of people's property tax bills. So if you're a retired person living in your home, you rely on the oil and gas industry to help keep your property taxes lower. We'll probably see an initiative measure come November about eliminating the state's property tax. I don't like paying property taxes, but I understand its function. But we need those natural resources here in North Dakota to alleviate property tax bills. If we didn't have that, and people are already complaining about their property tax bills, think how much higher that would be, 20% higher, without the Common Schools Trust Fund contributing to property tax relief and K-12 education. So that's my message of, even if you don't have children in public school, but you own a home or you own property, you're relying very heavily on natural resources here in North Dakota that are under siege, in my opinion, by the federal government.
Any other challenges, maybe with elections or other things that you're concerned about?
We talked about it briefly about the misinformation and disinformation. People are passionate about politics. People are passionate about the leaders they want to choose, or maybe passionate about of leaders they don't want to see lead their jurisdictions. That can elicit a lot of emotions and a lot of responses. Having our office explain how to vote, where to vote, what happens in that voting process, that's been a very challenging thing. And also just getting people to understand what the primary election is for. We've seen a bunch of advertising for the gubernatorial campaign for a United States House seat. I've talked to some folks, they don't realize that's decided on the Republican side, that's decided tomorrow, not in November. So that overall knowledge of civics here in North Dakota, that's an issue. We need to keep people engaged in that process and understanding of what elections mean, and elections have consequences, as we all know.
On the other side of that coin, when you surveyed the folks who were running for election or for re-election in the state, what came to your mind? Do you think that more folks should run based on how many people actually filed this time around? Did you ever think about that?
Do I think more people should have ran? Well, so there's five Republicans vying for the Republican nomination.
And even
for
in
the
state and even local races.
Yeah.
That
yeah, there. So I vote in the city of Mandan. There's some uncontested races there. What's the symptom? Is it the person currently in the position are doing such a great job? Everyone's saying, well, we don't need to run against that person. They're doing well. Or is it lack of engagement? I think in some pockets of the state, it's lack of engagement. In some pockets of the state, it's probably, you know what, that person's doing a heck of a job. I don't see why we need to run for that spot, because they're stepping up to the plate, willing to have that civic mind and civic duty of running for office.
What's your office's role tomorrow night?
We will be monitoring the results and really turnout, and we will be on the phone communicating with all 53 counties, making sure things are running seamlessly. If they have any problems, we'll try to point them in the right direction. The polls close at 7 p.m. your local time. So North Dakota, it'll be a 7 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. in Mountain Time. Results will not be on our website until 8 p.m. Central Time, because Mountain Time will still have to close. So our office, vote.nd.gov, will have the election results coming in. As soon as we get them, we'll start uploading them into the system, and they'll be made available for the public to observe, get out and vote, participate in the process.
Michael Howe, he was elected in November of 2022 and took office January 1st, 2023. He's North Dakota's Secretary of State. Thank you, Mr. New Father.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Main Street.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Each vote counts. Don't throw yours away. You can help to choose who will win or lose. So vote on election day. Vote, vote, vote.
The 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival is back at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn, Friday and Saturday, June 14th and 15th. You can enjoy some great picking with the High 48, Special Consensus, Kohlrabi Soup, Cottonwood, and the Bluestems. There will be great camping and late-night jamming. Bring your instrument and learn a bluegrass tune with one of the guest bands on Saturday. The 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, June 14th and 15th at the Cross Ranch State Park. More information at bluegrassnd.org or on Facebook. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 10th. Leading up to the June 11th primary, we're celebrating democracy in North Dakota history. Today we learn about the superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction. The department was created in 1863, which added an important political player to state government. The superintendent of the department was originally appointed by the Dakota Territory Board of Education, which included the territory's governor, secretary, and treasurer. After that, the position vacillated between elective and appointed. Originally acting as a school inspector and advisor to schools, the superintendent of public instruction began taking on additional responsibilities and powers, working with teachers, recommending textbooks, even deciding disputes under the laws that applied to schooling. The importance of schools was obvious. In the fifth annual report of the Territorial Superintendent of Public Instruction, E.W. Miller noted, "There is nothing our people should take more interest in than the cause of education. Our children must be educated, and we should be more liberal in the advancement of our educational interests than perhaps any and all others." By 1889, when North Dakota became a state, the new state constitution created the office as an elected 2-year term. In the early days, the position was held only by men, but women were involved. In 1888, even before statehood, they gained the right to vote in all school elections, and as it turned out, even run for the superintendent office. In 1892, Laura Eisenhut became the first woman in the country to be elected to a state office. In her report to the governor, the new superintendent wrote, "I feel highly gratified that I can report the school system of this state is in a healthy, growing condition. Although I cannot say that no mistakes have been made, I can truly say that, despite these trials to which every new state seems heir, we have steadily and surely progressed." In 1895, Eisenhut was succeeded by another woman when Emma Bates was elected. In a report to the governor, Bates heaped great thanks to teachers, stating, "We have tender and grateful remembrances of the teachers of the state, who have invariably shown an earnest, progressive spirit." Over the years, the position would continue to evolve, as it did in 1913, when state law required that the superintendent be elected on a no-party ballot. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us today. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org.
Tomorrow on the show, there's nothing quite like storytelling. We visit with Stacy Nicholson and Lori Baker about the power of storytelling. And Wayne Salter, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, stops by Main Street to talk about North Dakota's goal of being the healthiest state in the country. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us then.